Hello, this is Imogen Ragone at Body Learning. Robert Rickover has kindly agreed to let me use the Body Learning podcast to conduct a series of interviews with different Alexander Technique teachers, maybe especially the more senior and successful teachers, to find out how they go about teaching a first lesson. I believe and hope this will become a valuable resource for the rest of us. So, today my guest is John Nichols. John trained with Walter and Dilys Carrington in the 1970s and started teaching in 1976. He remained with them for 11 years, assisting daily on their teacher training course and maintaining a large private practice of his own. Since then, he's been director of training courses in Melbourne, Australia, Brighton in England, and since 2003 in New York City, where, as well as a teacher certification program, he offers private lessons, hands-on supervision groups for teachers, and structured postgraduate courses for teachers. Since moving to the USA, John has been a featured teacher and presenter at several AMSAT conferences and international congresses. He also travels frequently to lead seminars for the public, postgraduate classes for teachers, and to consult on training courses in Britain, Denmark, Germany, Holland, Italy, Australia, New Zealand, and Brazil. Wow. Okay, welcome to the
Thank you, Imogen. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
John. Well, I'm very excited to have you as one of my, I was going to say victims, one of my interviewees
Oh.
on this topic. But yes, I'm very excited to learn more about your approach to a first lesson. So I've had two or three lessons with you at conference, at AMSAT conferences, which is
Yes.
sort of out of a context of a normal first lesson. And of course, it wasn't a real first lesson, if you know what I mean. I'm really talking about a first lesson to someone who's not had any Alexander Technique
Of course, yeah.
experience before. So when a new a prospective new student contacts you, whether that's by email or phone, do you have a particular way of handling it? Maybe specific questions you ask or information that you want to give them before you meet them?
Pretty much the sort of thing that most experienced teachers would say. I think the first thing is to find out what sparked their interest. What is it that spurred them to think, hey, I'd like to try this Alexander Technique thing? Because I think that's essential. You've got to then speak to them from where they're coming from. You said when they first contact you by email or phone, I've noticed, certainly here in New York, in the last 2 or 3 years, or maybe 3 or 4 years, hardly anybody contacts me by phone, Imogen.
Well, I agree. I get most of my
It's all
contacts by
email.
email.
And I actually know people who have the ringer of their phone turned off 24/7. Because, phones are not for all, phones are for texting and emailing.
That's
So
right.
that's what I get more. And therefore, that has the advantage that when people contact me first by email, they do tend to themselves spontaneously write a bit more about why they're contacting me. So that helps the process.
Okay, and would you do you give them any information or give them ahead, or do you just really talk to drawing out what their concern is?
I do like to find out whether they, well, I like to get some idea of how much they know about the Alexander Technique, saying, have you read anything about it? Do you have any friends who have lessons? Have you taken a look around the internet for any of the information about it? And I'd like them at least to go take a look at my website. I'd say, have a look at some of the general stuff on my website about the technique, and specifically have a look at the page about taking private lessons. Mm-hmm. So you've got some idea what to expect.
And would usually your whole kind of contact maybe be only by email before you meet them?
Most commonly these days, that's exactly
yes,
the case.
I mean, that's kind of what I thought you was. And yeah, I would say yes, that's true for me too. I know some teachers, even though the contact might be by email, they'll ask to talk on the phone first.
I've gotten used to the fact
yeah,
that they don't have the ringer turned on. Mm-hmm. What's the use? No, I'm kidding. But no, people just seem to expect a couple of exchanges of emails and we'll set up an appointment. So I also have, you know, this might be a useful thing mm-hmm. for a new teacher in preparation for that situation. I've got a couple of prepared, pre-written emails, like templates. Mm-hmm. That I can shoot off to people with minor alterations. And one of them gives my typical weekly schedule so that you know they get an idea of when I'm available for lessons and when I'm not available.
Okay, well, that's great. Mm-hmm.
And that gets things off to a good start because then they can get back to me and say, well, how about, do you have anything on Wednesday afternoons after 5, say?
So it doesn't even start by them asking for times when you're just not going to possibly be available. So,
exactly.
Yeah,
okay, I'm saying this is when I'm available. And it also, actually, the pre-written email even says, of course, some of these times may well be currently regularly booked. Mm-hmm. And then I say something like, but give me a few suggestions of mm-hmm. times that would work for you. In other words, don't just ask for one specific time. Give me a few, mm-hmm. and we'll see what we can work out together from that.
Yep, sounds good. So
there's a second. Yeah. There's
okay.
A second. Sorry, I just think this. You know, this is kind of useful stuff.
Absolutely.
There's a second one that gives them the specific info about where I'm located and possible ways of getting here, etc., uh-huh. and cost of the lesson, things like that. You know, okay. Please wear loose, comfortable clothing.
Yes.
As we all say, don't we?
Do you have any forms that you have people fill out, or?
God, no.
No. All right. That's the simple answer to that. So how important is this first lesson?
Well, obviously, everyone's going to say, especially if you're a fairly new teacher, mm-hmm. At the back of your mind is the anxiety about getting paid, you know, mm-hmm. paying the rent. Mm-hmm. So there's pressure on the teacher in that way that you feel, oh, I really need this person to come back and take more lessons. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. if you possibly can put that on the back burner, put it aside a little.
Inhibit
because
that?
I guess we could use that word. If you can think of it more as the beginning of an ongoing process, because I think a lot of teachers try to throw everything into the first lesson, every angle, every aspect of the Alexander technique, and that can come across as a little too desperate. Mm-hmm. Not only that, but it tends to influence the teacher's own use a bit negatively because you're pressing down a bit into yourself because you're trying so hard. You know? Mm-hmm. So if you can step back a little metaphorically and try to see this as the beginning of a long process, you're just laying the foundation stone.
Yeah, I like that. That's nice.
And I know from training teachers, Imogen, that you know, one of the unfairnesses of life, in this case, which mm-hmm. there are many, mm-hmm. is that it takes a bit of confidence to step back like that. Mm. And often you get more of that confidence from experience. But yes. You know, the like the catch 22 of mm-hmm. this is that the time in your Alexander teaching career when you most need that confidence is the time when you have the least of it. Mm. It's when you just start teaching. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you just pretend a bit, just pretend.
Yeah.
Hey, I've been doing this for years.
Well, you sort of mentioned payment a little bit, and I had a question around payment. And to be clear, I'm not asking about how much you're charging, though of course that's another question we all struggle with. Rather the kind of the system or even protocol, you might say, that you use to collect payment. I think it's often a kind of an awkward moment for us all, that moment where we kind of ask for the money. So do you ask for it in advance, or is it the beginning of the lesson, or the end of the lesson, or have you got any suggestions? How do you do it?
Well, I make sure that we've established in writing by email before they even come what the fee is going to be.
That's good.
So there's no arguing about that. I mean, having said that, of course, I give discounts to some people. So we work that out ahead if possible as well. And I also will have mentioned that, you know, you can pay me by check or cash, doesn't matter to me. If paying by check, please make it payable to. And then I'm kind of habituated to people paying me at the end of a lesson on the basis that, you know, when I go to a doctor, a dentist, any kind of service, most commonly we'll be dealing with payment at the end of the service. I know there's a few places, a few medical places I've been to where they get you to pay your copay first. But I think mostly you go to an acupuncturist, you go, hey, I go and get my hair cut. Do I pay at the beginning? No, I pay at the end. So I tend to leave it like that. And normally I don't even have to say anything about it because I find that most people expect that. So when we get to the end of the lesson, they'll often be reaching for their purse, wallet, checkbook, or whatever. If they don't, and if they've, you know, they've got their shoes on, they've got their coat on, then I will actually say, now I need to ask you for some payment, you know, or some such, you know, kind of question. And, you know, the person will say, oh, of course, I'm sorry. It's no big deal, you know, just that little reminder, you know, before you walk out the door, we have to deal with this.
I think we make a bigger deal of it in our minds often.
As
with most things, right?
Of course, you know, consult your own experience of going to classes and services of all those kinds. It's no big deal. You settle up at the end. There's also a couple of things. I have a few people who will, they come in and they push the check in my hand at the beginning of the lesson. And I stuff it into my pocket and we go through the lesson. And then I've several times been in the embarrassing situation as they're leaving of saying, oh, by the way, give me a check. And they say, John, I gave it to you.
Because it wasn't following the normal routine.
I kind of encourage people to stick to my routine and then we don't get those embarrassments.
Okay, very good. So when your student walk through the door, how do you start? Do you I'm guessing you haven't even chatted on the phone with a lot of them, so
well, that's right.
It's the first time hearing their voice, let alone seeing them. So do you start with a discussion, or how do you start?
Well, the studio I normally work from fortunately has a sofa. So, you know, I usher them in, leave your coat here, there's the bathroom if you need it, take a seat over here on the sofa and we'll talk about it. And I would have referred back to their initial one or two emails, so I'll have something that's reminded me, you know, oh, this person's here because they've got chronic back trouble, or this is a violinist. So, you know, they sit down on the sofa and we have a little chat about that. I get a bit of further information from them. I check that they've had a little read of say, something on the website. Mm-hmm. So they've got some idea what to expect. And, of course, you do get some people who would happily sit there and tell you about themselves for the next 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you do have to sort of intervene a little bit and say, well, you know, we can best make use of this time if I actually show you really what happens in an Alexander lesson. So would you mind, would you just leave your shoe? I often get people to leave their shoes off because I'm going to lie them down. Actually, come to think of it, I don't do that. I wait until we get to the lying down stage. I'll ask them to take off a jacket or anything that might get in the way, and come and stand in front of this chair. This chair being a hard wooden chair, mm-hmm. because I want to say to them something like, "We're going to be working with you standing, sitting, making a few simple movements, and lying down in a certain way." And for this purpose, I'm going to use this firm, flat chair because what we're really interested in here is how you support yourself. So that means we don't want you leaning back there on the sofa, letting the sofa support you. And we really don't want lots of padding in the chair helping to support you and cushion you. Because also that disguises things about how you support yourself. You really get the full, clear picture when there's the simplicity of something firm and flat underneath you. Mm. So we're going to come over here and work with this.
So the chair is the place where you start.
Yes.
With people. That sounds pretty clear.
I can give you then the rationale I would give them for that. But let me tell you this. Yeah, I think, let me tell you what was a revelatory moment for me way back when I'd begun teaching, had I, or was about to. A friend of mine took some lessons with Dilys Carrington. Mm-hmm. And Dilys Carrington was a wonderful teacher. I admired and liked her very much. I learned a lot from her. But my friend only had 3 or 4 or 5 lessons and stopped. And I was disappointed. So I said, hey, I thought you were liking this. What made you decide not to continue? And she said, well, John, the lying down bit was nice, but everything else was about sitting down and standing up. And you know what I do? I work all day standing behind the counter in a bookstore. So I'm standing all day. And you know where I live? And I should say this was kind of neo-hippie phase. Uh-huh. There wasn't a chair in the apartment. There was a futon on the floor and there were cushions on the floor. Mm-hmm. She literally never sat down and stood up in that kind of way. Mm-hmm. The revelation for me was
so it didn't seem relevant to her. Is that
That we had to reframe this chair thing. Mm-hmm. Because I do feel that chair work is enormously valuable. Mm-hmm. There are good reasons why Alexander kept doing it for 50-odd years. It wasn't because the man was, too uncreative, too unimaginative mm-hmm. to think of anything else. There's something very fundamental about it in terms of how we coordinate upright posture and movement. But to begin with, I want to talk a little, communicate with the person about what we call going up and using simple everyday language expressions built into our language are phrases like, I've had a terrible week. Things at work are really getting me down. I'm under so much pressure. Mm-hmm. My boss is on my back. Everything's becoming a burden. I can't wait for the weekend so I can take time to decompress. Pressure, mm-hmm. compression, something's on my back. And then there's language about breathing. I'm stifled. I need room to breathe mm-hmm. and so on. Mm-hmm. I think this is an interesting way in towards how these are not just metaphors – and they're more than purely mental states. I love this word attitude that really communicates, you know, that these are attitudes. And they get locked into us physically. We actually compress physically. Mm-hmm. We stifle ourselves physically. And we get so accustomed to it that even after the particular horrible circumstances, say at work, have eased off, the person has become habituated to those muscular patterns. And it's a little bit like having, say, dark-tinted lenses implanted in your eyes and everything looks darker. But after a little while, you forget. Mm-hmm. Well, that's just how everything looks. Mm-hmm. Until there's a possibility of removing them and, oh my God, oh, I didn't realize the world looked like that, you know? Mm-hmm. So I want to communicate that this is really about allowing yourself to lighten up and open out. And I'll say, can I put hands on you now to just demonstrate how we work? And they'll say, yes. I haven't had that before to say no.
Oh, good. I was wondering what you would say.
And I start talking to them about releasing up through the back and sides of the neck and letting your head lighten up and just follow where my hands seem to be encouraging you to go. And now let's just move from standing. You just sit yourself down there. Chair's right behind you. And we'll work a little bit at, you know, getting that lightening up and letting the head come up out of the shoulders and let your back and sides widen to breathe. Really let yourself open out through the back and sides to breathe as you let your neck and head lighten up. And let's just come back up to standing now.
So I'm smiling here. I'm feeling better just listening to you say all that.
But you see how the in and out of the chair to begin with is trivial. The focus isn't on that at all. The focus is on actually, can you let yourself, or another phrase of mine, can you let yourself relax upwards and outwards? Everybody relaxes downwards and inwards. We're aiming to reverse that. We want to redefine posture and redefine relaxation.
Oh, I like that a lot.
slowly and subtly, I can shift from you sit yourself down, stand yourself up, to phrases like, now let's just come back into the chair again, and let's just come back up to standing. And almost imperceptibly, within virtually a few minutes, we're into this, I'm guiding them in and out of the chair, and it's no big deal. There's no need for any of that kerfuffle and palaver about it.
Nice. Could there be any reason why you would change things up and not start with someone in the chair?
Yes. Before I get to that, let me add one more thing that I've found very, very useful in recent years. We try to explain to people that we don't want them to pull the head back. And that's so difficult to communicate. Mm-hmm. In simple movements where the body is folding at the joints, movements like going to sit down or unfolding, coming back to standing, folding to go down to pick something up, folding to reach over for something. The phrase, let your head go with your spine, I find a very, very useful one, that what we call pulling the head back is really when the spine is aiming in one direction, but the head is trying to go in a direction that's opposed to that. So letting the head go with the spine, I find, is a neat way to get into that territory more easily.
Yeah, that's nice too. This is great. So you said there was very occasionally times when you don't start.
Of course,
there. Yes.
I mean, the obvious one is particularly particular pain or disability situations. Where that might not seem appropriate. Now, That's pretty rare, but really difficult arthritic pain. Well, as a matter of fact, I'm just thinking aloud. I'm remembering how a man came to see me when I was living in Melbourne, Australia, who he'd had a motorbike accident, and the knee, one knee, was fixed. It didn't bend. After the accident. A little tricky in and out of the chair. So we started off on the table. Mm-hmm. Painful arthritic hips, these sorts of things. You might find it easier to start with the table. You might actually find you have to improvise and just start from where they are. You're sitting in the sofa. Can you just let your head come out a little bit, let your back widen, you feel your back against the back of the sofa and see if you can just let the breathing spread through there. So you might have to improvise in those situations. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. So pain and disability, I think.
Yeah. So you've been teaching a while now, as we discovered in the introduction. How would you compare how you teach a first lesson now to when you first started out?
Oh, that's a frightening thought.
What has changed in your approach?
Practically, yeah. I mean, why did they ever come back, those first ones? Boy. I say that half joking. I look back and think that my first lessons were so crummy compared to things now. But people did come back. Yeah. And I think that's also, it's a useful thing for a new teacher to be reminded of, that Marjorie Barlow, who was a niece of FM's, she said to me in a conversation about this that she'd asked FM how did he feel about the future of his work, given that there might be all sorts of variations in levels and quality of teaching. And that he said to her he was confident it would survive because of the basic soundness, or the soundness of its basic principles. It's like there's something so biophysiologically right about the fact that any vertebrate creature with four limbs and a head and a thorax functions well when the spine is at its natural resilient length, and the head is not locked at the top end of the spine, and when the back and sides, the ribs are free to move through the back and sides. It's just a fact. And if you can communicate something of that, people get benefit. But I did what probably many new teachers do. I just copied what I saw more experienced teachers doing. Mm-hmm. I just religiously tried to do what they did. And at that time in London, the focus was very much on people. You get people to go in and out of the chair, and they'll pull their head back. And you point out to them that they're pulling their head back and that that's a bad idea. And you help them not to pull their head back. And they'll feel better. They'll feel, that's lighter and freer and easier. And my very first paying student, when she went in and out of the chair, she wasn't visibly pulling her head back.
So what did you do?
I think I'm in denial of it, because honestly, Imogen, I can't even remember what I did. Mm. I do remember panic. Mm. So I think I've gone unconscious about it. And then I remember that after about four lessons, she told me she wasn't getting anything from this and she wasn't going to come back.
Oh dear!
It was pretty. It was pretty rough way to start. Mm. And about 6 months later, quite by chance, I found myself walking behind her along the street at Notting Hill Gate in London, near where the Carrington's place was. And as I walked along behind her, looking at her head and neck, it dawned on me that she was so locked there that there was no visible change. So that this idea that, you know, she'd visibly pull her head back hadn't worked. It just was,
it was locked
cemented.
Place. Yeah. Oh, wow.
Nobody had ever told me that that could happen. So, you know, gradually I realized that that way of going about it didn't work for me. And then I had that experience, as I say, of the friend of mine going to Dilis. And I realized, you know, okay, chair work, table work, they're fantastic. We really don't want to lose them. They are still, to me, the best way to bring about long-term, profound, and deep change. But we have to reframe what they mean, so to speak.
Make them relevant. Yeah.
Make them relevant. Get away from what you don't want is, now this is the Alexander way to sit down and stand up. Now next week, we do the Alexander way of picking up your shopping basket. And we're going to do the Alexander way of changing a light bulb, etc. You don't want that, really. You want the, there's a fundamental principle that you're trying to communicate about, as I say, relax upwards and outwards. Learn not to squeeze and stifle yourself.
Great. Do you give your students any homework after their first lesson?
Yes, yes. Two basic things. Because I think the lying down in semi-supine is phenomenally valuable.
Yes,
I mean,
so do I.
Here we are. We've been in this for decades. You know, I lie down every day. Walter, in the years I knew him, could be found lying down on his teaching table after lunch every day. So I'm strongly, I show them about it in the first lesson. I after a bit of chair, I get them to the table. And that's where I would get them to take off their shoes, by the way.
Yeah, makes sense.
And, you know, encourage them, show them the height of books under the head. I give them, I have a pre-written single sheet with some simple instructions and advice about that that they can take away, or I can shoot them a PDF version of it attached to an email. So homework number one, do this every day. Homework number two is, bearing in mind what we've talked about releasing up and opening out and letting yourself breathe and so on, see if you can remind yourself as often as possible during the day. Just check back in with yourself. What am I doing with myself? Am I actually constricting? Am I pressing down? Am I dragging my head towards my shoulders? And I'm very keen on giving visual demonstrations at great sacrifice to myself. I'm probably shortening my life by years, but... You know, it's all in the service of a good So, you know, you stand in front of the person and say, you know, you might find yourself like this. And I do a little, you know, neck pulled forward, head pulled back compression thing, or sitting like this. And then you say to yourself, hey, I've learned I don't really need this. So can I just remember that upward release? Let the head come up. I talk about let the back of your head come up away from your shoulders or away from your back, rather than that terrible phrase, forward and up. So along those lines, you know, asking them to start noticing, wake up and consider what you're doing with yourself frequently during the day, whenever there's opportunities, whenever things, there's a change in your routine. Get up, walk away from the computer as often as you can, at least for a few minutes in every hour. Use all these opportunities to check back in with yourself.
Yeah, no, that's great. So you do have a handout for the constructive rest or semi-supine.
Yeah.
Do you have handouts on anything else?
Yeah. the kind of stuff I've just said, I actually have a handout about using this basic pattern of directive intentions, releasing in the directions that help you to open out. I have some notes about that with some little really simple drawings that I send them away with as well.
Okay.
And I'll always say then, have a read of these, and if they raise any questions, just make a note and ask me next time. So we're assuming there is a next time, of course.
I think we've kind of touched on this a few times already, but what would you see as some of the sort of typical or potential mistakes a new teacher might make in a first lesson? I mean, I know I can think of is that we want to just try and tell them everything, which is impossible and not useful.
Yeah, I mean, we that's the biggest one, isn't it? That's the biggest one. This kitchen sink sort of, I'll throw everything at them and hope that something sticks. Talking too fast. And this is something where, again, it becomes so clear that all of this is about attitude. Because when you're trying to tell them too much, you're coming from a place where you're over-anxious about the result and you're trying too hard. And that will manifest itself also in your hands, you know, because you'll probably be doing too much. You'll probably, I mean, I was terrible at that. I used to really pull people around. Somebody once described me as an Alexander Rolfer.
Oh dear.
I don't think it was a compliment. And, you know, it all comes from that anxiety of, I desperately want them to have a feeling. I want to give them an experience that'll make them come back. But when you consider what is it we're trying to teach? What we're trying to teach is exactly the opposite of that.
Right.
So here I am. Well, you can see what I mean. You know, the messenger isn't exactly listening to the message while trying to communicate it.
Right.
So if you can kind of see it like that, that it all stems from this over anxiety to get the person to feel something. Consult your own experience. How do you feel when somebody's giving you a hard sell? And do you like it when a teacher really pulls you about?
You know? No.
So consult your own experience on that score. And I think one of the things past experiences that I've found strangely helpful was having been in the computer industry, but I was a terrible programmer, shockingly bad. I'm not sure that I remember any of my programs ever actually working, and I managed to get out before the management realized this, and I sidetracked into being a technical writer. When you write instruction manuals, the key is to imagine yourself in the role of the reader who's never encountered this software system before. Well, the key to any good teaching is to imagine yourself in the role of the student. And it really is helpful, you know, as an Alexander teacher giving a first lesson, to try to observe your own communications with the ears and eyes of the beginner. How is this really going to come across? And that it's a key to good teaching of anything.
Yes.
And I got one. Can I do one more thing?
Sure, absolutely.
Because given that I'm saying don't try to teach everything about the Alexander technique in one lesson, which bit are you going to teach?
Right. Yeah.
Now, this is a really good question, because, you know, you can come at the technique from so many different angles. Is it head balance? Is it going up? Is it inhibition? You know, is it ease of movement? I don't know what. Is it breathing? Is it learning to stop? We could go on. Figure out what to you is the most important aspect and the one that you want to lay down as the foundation stone. If you think of that first lesson not as a one-off, but as the beginnings of a process, you're laying the foundation stone and that you can build on. Mm-hmm. So have a think about what for you is the really lays the groundwork from which you can then explain over a series of lessons all the other aspects.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. So before we finish up, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners? Maybe advice for new teachers or anything that's relevant to our discussion?
The only thing that crosses my mind, really, Imogen, is just to point out that, you know, we'll, at whatever level you're at, or certainly, you know, after the number of years I've been teaching, mm-hmm. I still get people who come for a first lesson and don't come back. It's not a failure, you know. For some people, this just isn't the right thing. Mm-hmm. Or this is not the right time in their life. So, you know, I know it's all very well for me to say, don't get downhearted about it. But I'm going to say it anyway. Don't get downhearted about it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably not a personal thing. It's something to do with what's going on with them, not...
Yes.
That's kind of my take, but yeah, anyway.
Yes, yes. And this work is, it feels personal to us, mm-hmm. you know, so it's very easy to take it as a personal disappointment. Mm-hmm. But if you can step back and realize it really isn't for everybody. Some people don't feel a thing, you know, at the end of a lesson. I had a man recently came back and had a second lesson and didn't feel a thing. And okay, you know.
Interesting.
So,
yeah.
You just can't get through to everyone, and it may be that it isn't for that person. Period. They're just really temperamentally not on this wavelength. Or this is just not the right time in their life for it.
Okay, yes, very good. Well, John, this has been so interesting. I think that, honestly, I think this will be really useful to our listeners. So, my guest today has been John Nichols, an Alexander Technique teacher in New York City. If you'd like to get in touch with John, or you live in New York City, we'll put a link to his website next to the interview, and we'll also put a link to a site where you can find a teacher anywhere in the world. Thank you so much, John, for being on the show.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Imogen. Thanks.
Okay, bye.